Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Of all the sesquicentennials of the Civil War we're in the midst of in this stretch of years, the biggest may be right now, July 1 to 3, the 3rd, the Battle of Gettysburg. It was astonishingly bloody, everything on the line. The war would go on for two more years, but when Gettysburg was over, the Confederacy would never again threaten the Union on its own turf. It was, Lincoln said, where freedom was reborn, where the project of democracy was saved. This hour on Point, the Battle of Gettysburg at 150. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. How do you think about Gettysburg, the nearly 60,000 casualties, General Lee, General Meade, those days of battle and the stakes? Did your ancestors fight there, die there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A special welcome to our longtime Wisconsin listeners, now listening live on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. It's nice to have you right here. And to Oklahoma listeners, now with us 2 hours every day. In a minute, three big historians on Gettysburg, but there are a lot of reenactors gathering there in these days. Here's some battle sound from the first Battle of Gettysburg reenactments that took place over the weekend in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And they are still at it. Let's go right there to the Union reenactors' encampment in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. July 2nd, 1863 was the second day of the Great Battle. July 2nd, 2013, today, Kyle Wichtendahl, a Civil War reenactor from Sharpsburg, Maryland, is there, camping out 19th century style this week in Gettysburg. Kyle Wichtendahl, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Describe your surroundings there in the camp. Do you have old-style tents and uniforms and the whole works?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We're starting to set up our encampment here. All the staff and headquarters people have arrived here on site yesterday. So today we're starting to get all of our reenactors in. All of the troops are starting to fill out, and they're slowly trickling in here today, and they'll trickle in. And we're putting up our authentic canvas tents, and some people are in uniform already, and some people are yet to change in from the drive. So.
What's it like to wear those scratchy old wool uniforms in the summer heat, 1863 or 2013, either way, Kyle? What's it like? How's it feel?
You know, I mean, they're not too bad. I mean, you know, they didn't know any different back then. And, I mean, they're fairly comfortable. You know, they're actually a lot worse when it's cold outside. They're probably not warm enough when it's cold, but we're used to it. And, I mean, the wool trousers aren't too scratchy. We're wearing the correct style of undergarment, so it keeps them from being too scratchy.
Do you carry some kind of period arms yourself, Kyle?
I'm a staff officer here, so I serve as the aide-de-camp to the commanding general. Alan Baldwin is his name. He's not portraying a particular figure here. He's really just our general and reenacting. And I carry just a sword on the battlefield with me. Now, these enlisted guys out here who are serving in the ranks, they're carrying, most of them are carrying a 58 caliber Springfield rifled musket. And that's a single-shot muzzle-loading weapon.
As an aide-de-camp to a general in the reenactment, will you actually ever be out on the battlefield in the bloody thick of it, or will you be behind the lines?
Absolutely. I'll be out on the battlefield. I'll also be behind the lines. Essentially, the aide-de-camp, he's the right-hand man to the general. So that could involve just about anything that the general needs. It could be menial work like shining his buttons or helping him with his belt, but it could be really important work, sending him out on the battlefield, making sure that a whole wing of the army stays where he wants it to, could be relaying orders. Essentially, the aide-de-camp is an extension of the general, because the general is just one man. He can't be everywhere, but his staff officers are responsible for extending his authority and his sight to all areas of the field.
We've got thousands and thousands of reenactors there in these several days. It may be the high point of reenactment in the sesquicentennial stretch of years. Reenacting Union troops, Confederate, Southern troops. Why do you do it personally, Kyle? What brings you out there?
Well, I've always had a great passion for Civil War history. I find all American history fascinating, but the Civil War history in general. And I think that's probably because I grew up in this area. I grew up in Maryland, and it's always been right out the back door. It's always been here. And it's a really important time in our nation's history. And what better way to really experience it than to go out and actually try to relive some of it. And not only are we doing it for ourselves, but we're doing it for the public as well. We like nothing more than to talk to the public when they come in and we explain to them what's going on here. And I think that's partly why I like staff work so much, because it's an unusual thing that most people don't think about, but very important.
When will you hit the battlefield, Kyle?
We're actually going to start fighting on Thursday. Thursday evening will be our first scenarios. And we probably won't have all of our reenactors here because some people have to work. But by the time we get to Saturday and the weekend, we'll have full strength here. And we'll have over 10,000 reenactors on the field.
Wow. Wow. That's big. Good luck. I guess we know how it turns out, but we wish you good luck anyway. Kyle, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Kyle Wichtendahl taking part in the big Gettysburg reenactments going on this week in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Joining us now also from Gettysburg is Alan Gelzo, professor of history and Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College. His big new book getting lots of attention is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Alan Gelzo, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Why do you call it The Last Invasion, sir?
Because it really was the last full-scale invasion the Confederacy was able to mount of the North. Robert E. Lee had tried to invade the North in 1862, and that had been broken off. And he tried again in 1863, and that met with the conclusion that we're all familiar with at Gettysburg. After that, the Confederacy is never really able to mount an invasion again, and in fact, really, it's a very slow step downwards, even a spiral downwards, from Gettysburg to the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia at Appomattox 21 months later.
You write very compellingly about the bloody toll of Gettysburg. Just remind us, on each side, what the losses were.
Well, the numbers can be a little uncertain because there were no graves registration units, there were no modern ways of keeping track, but in general, I think it's safe to say that we're looking at somewhere between 50 and 60,000 total casualties. That's killed, wounded, missing. Of that number, we're talking somewhere between 7 and 9,000 actually killed on the battlefield during the 3 days of fighting.
And what were the stakes on these 3 days in July in 1863?
Oh, they were enormous, because Robert E. Lee hoped that by bringing the war onto northern soil, he could, even if he didn't fight a battle, successfully demoralize what was already a very war-weary northern public. The first 6 months of 1863 had been very rough politically for the Lincoln administration. If Lee could demonstrate that he was able to move around northern soil without much in the way of obstruction, then the successive elections that were going to take place from the fall of 1863 and then all the way up to the election of 1864 would demonstrate that the Lincoln administration was bankrupt both militarily and politically, and that might force the Union to the negotiating table. And once that happened, well, that would really be the game over, because no one was going to go back to fighting once negotiations had begun.
Lee had been winning again and again in the South. With this push, he was hoping, what, to break through, threaten Washington, threaten Philadelphia, and change the political chemistry, as you say?
Absolutely. I mean, one aim he has certainly is to get the war off the soil of Virginia and the Confederacy, because even though he had won battle after battle after battle, that had all taken place on Virginia soil, and that really gave the Virginia economy and the Southern economy a shellacking. And Lee understood, probably better than any Southern leader, that the Confederacy could not win a long, protracted war. It couldn't go. It didn't have the resources to go 15 rounds. It had to get in there in the first couple of rounds and score a knockout. And that's why he moves into Pennsylvania.
What determined this great battle? Was it the geography of Gettysburg? Was it something about the generalship? Robert E. Lee had quite the reputation coming in. He was very aggressive, despite his kind of man of marble reputation. What determined Gettysburg?
Well, it's hard to say that Gettysburg was determined, because there are some elements in 19th century warfare that are always going to be governed by improvisation. But geography does play a large role in it, because Gettysburg is located at the intersection of as many as 10 roads, and those are roads that run north-south, east-west, right at the center of the broad plain between the beginning of the Appalachian Mountains and the Susquehanna River. So anyone who was going to move north or south or east or west was sooner or later really going to have to come through Gettysburg.
And so there it was, and Lee, in the end, didn't make it. Pickett's charge was on the third day. Was that, as William Faulkner had it, the moment when the South's dreams died, when they did not break through the Union lines?
Well, it did seem that way to many Southerners after the battle. Many of them wrote back in their letters to home or in their diaries how utterly miserable the Army of Northern Virginia was at the prospect of its defeat, that it had been the worst catastrophe to overcome the Confederate Army since the fall of New Orleans back in April of 1862. But at the moment when Lee plans this attack, it really did seem to be the right thing to do, because the Union Army at that point, the third day of the battle, really looked like it was on the ropes. And Lee had an entire fresh division, and if he put that into the balances, then all it might take would be one good punch, and the Army of the Potomac, the Union Army, would be flat out on the canvas.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Battle of Gettysburg at 150, the sesquicentennial of Pickett's Charge, Cemetery Ridge, the last full measure of devotion, Lincoln's great speech that would come, the most famous battle of the Civil War. What it meant, what it means. Here's a little bit from the 1993 film Gettysburg. Union General Joshua Chamberlain, played by Jeff Daniels, gives a speech to a group of mutineers to convince them to stay in, join the fight. He talks about what the battle means and why they're fighting.
America should be free ground, all of it, not divided by a line between slave state and free, all the way from here to the Pacific Ocean. No man has to bow, no man born to royalty. Here we judge you by what you do, not by who your father was. Here you can be something.
Crickets and violins when we remember the Battle of Gettysburg. It can get very high blown. The stakes were high, but the battle was as bloody as a battle can be. Alan Gelzo writes about it in his new book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. He joins us from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I want to bring a couple of other great historians in with us right now alongside Alan Gelzo. With us from Charlottesville, Virginia is Gary Gallagher, professor of history at the University of Virginia. His new book is Becoming Confederates, Paths to a New National Loyalty. Gary Gallagher in Virginia, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Delighted to be here.
And with us from New Haven, Connecticut, David Blight is here, professor of American history at Yale University. His latest book is American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era. David Blight, wonderful to have you with us as well. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Delighted to be here on this anniversary.
David, we've begun to hear a little bit from Alan Gelzo. Give us your sort of bottom line on what Gettysburg meant, A, to the war and immediately, and then B, to the nation.
Well, Alan is quite right, of course, that there were enormous stakes in the Gettysburg campaign at that moment in the war. The North was in trouble, and a victory by the Army of Northern Virginia in Pennsylvania that truly had threatened Washington, Philadelphia, and beyond could have brought a different outcome to this war. Surely, the American Republic as formed in the 18th century was at stake, but also at stake, of course, was slavery. And something close to one-third of the members of Lee's army were either slaveholders themselves or members of families who were slaveholders. Something close to one-half of his officer corps were slaveholders. There were several thousand slaves as camp hands and workers forced to serve Lee's army that invaded Pennsylvania. So the fate of an American republic that would be ultimately redefined, reimagined, as Lincoln was saying in the Gettysburg Address, mm-hmm. reborn in some new form, was at stake as well. But if we can only try to imagine the meaning of this war after a Confederate victory rather than a Union victory, then we do have some sense of what was truly at stake.
Gary Gallagher, remind us of the spirits of the Army of Virginia, Lee's army, coming into this, how high they were after all their victories.
They had extremely high morale going into Pennsylvania. They were coming off two substantial victories at Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville, and Lee had forged a bond with his soldiers that was unparalleled during the war. On either side, there's no other army on either side that had this fundamental bond and trust between the commander and the men in the ranks. As David and Alan have said, there's a great deal at stake. Lee understood, I think, better than many others at the time, that the key to victory lay with persuading the civilian population of the United States that the war was simply costing too much. It wasn't worth it. And that the best way to do that was to defeat the most famous army of the Republic, the Army of the Potomac, in a way that would dampen morale. I think that is one of the things he was seeking. And I think it's important for us to remember that the war could have gone either way. I think too often Americans mm-hmm. assume United States victory was inevitable, and it was not.
If they had broken through, let's say with Pickett's Charge, if they had been successful in Gettysburg, what was Lee's military plan?
Well, I think Lee's military plan always was to inflict the greatest damage possible on his opponent. So if he had managed some kind of a breakthrough, he would have tried to exploit that success. There was a fascinating difference in the cultures of command in the Army of the Potomac and the Army of Northern Virginia. There's a very aggressive culture of command set by Lee in the Army of Northern Virginia that sought always to harm the opponent as much as possible. There's a much more cautious culture of command in the Army of the Potomac, a legacy of George B. McClellan's tenure as commander of the Army.
Alan Gelzo, you write about tensions in the officer corps of the South and of the North. Describe those tensions to us. Maybe start wherever you like, and then take us to General Meade, the commanding general for the North.
Well, this attaches to what Gary was saying about the different cultures of the Army. And even within the Army, both armies, in fact, there were contradictory cultures. Within the Army of Northern Virginia, there were ardent secessionists who had very ill-concealed suspicions about people whom they considered as not entirely enthusiastic enough about the secessionist cause or even about protecting slavery.
In their own ranks, they were skeptical of,
yes,
of their mates.
Yes, there was a Virginia hierarchy in this army, which gave most of the rewards and most of the top positions to Virginians and to secessionists. And those who weren't Virginians and those who maybe didn't display as much enthusiasm as it was felt they should have about secession generally tended to be shunted off to the side, not to get promotion. And there was a great deal of bitterness within the army over those perceptions, over that mistrust.
And the tensions in the Northern Command?
Something of the same thing, because so much of the Army of the Potomac had, as Gary said, been created by George McClellan. George McClellan was in many respects a very talented soldier, but he was a soldier who could not keep his politics, which in this case were anti-Lincoln, anti-emancipation politics, out of military decision-making. And he had created an army command culture which was very skeptical of Lincoln, very skeptical of what Lincoln was trying to do with emancipation, and which really believed that the best solution to the entire problem of the war was for the conservative, the moderate members of both sides to get together and have some kind of negotiated settlement. George Meade, commanding the Army of the Potomac, was one of the people who was part of the network of McClellanites in the Army of the Potomac, and Meade himself had advocated on more than one occasion the position that, you know, we should negotiate this, we shouldn't make slavery a non-negotiable issue, we should try to find some kind of quid pro quo. In the eyes of people like Meade and the McClellanites, Lincoln and the Republicans were as much responsible for the war and its destruction as the secessionists were, and they were happy to call a pox on both their houses.
He was put in charge just 3 days before the battle. You describe him as a fussy, cautious commander, and yet there was a Union victory.
Well, in large measure, he wins because Robert E. Lee loses. And after all, there have been some great commanders who have won great victories and then lost it all through one battle. And then there have been some commanders who have been first-rate, second-rate men who've won one battle, but that was enough to plant the laurels on their brow. And I think that George Meade, in large measure, belongs in that second category, because Meade, as commander at Gettysburg, really does not give a whole lot in the way of direction. He's more like the boy putting his finger into holes in the dike than he is really directing a vigorous offense. If there's anyone who really deserves credit for Union victory at the Battle of Gettysburg, it's this galaxy of junior officers who take the initiative on their own without direction from the generals or from the big shots, the colonels, the brigadiers, sometimes even down on the level of the company captains and non-coms, who look at situations, make decisions on their own, turn the dime or turn the corner at just the right moment, and the results are favorable to the Union outcome. And that's especially true on July 2nd, when a series of incidents like this really comes through as the major story of July 2nd, 1863.
Describe one, put a name to the place, and what happened there?
The most famous, no question, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain at Little Round Top. But he's only one of many, and that's an important thing to remember, because a lot of people have focused on Joshua Chamberlain and Little Round Top, whether because of Michael Shara's famous novel, The Killer Angels, or for the movie Gettysburg that was made from it. But in truth, Chamberlain, and give Chamberlain credit, he did do the right thing. Chamberlain is really only one face in a crowd of people like Patrick O'Rourke, Governor Warren, Samuel Sprigg Carroll, who do exactly the same thing at different parts of the battlefield and at different times on July 2nd. Those are the guys who really saved the day for the Union Army.
David Blight in New Haven, where do you point when we want to think here about credit for victory and loss in the command structure, in the junior officer corps, in those troops in the field, the topography? Where do you look, David?
Oh, I think Alan is right. It has to be explained somehow within that unfathomable bravery and courage of those soldiers. And indeed, one of the reasons the American and international imagination has been so focused on Gettysburg and other battles, but particularly on Gettysburg over the years, is just this mystery in some ways of how so many men would stand elbow to elbow in those fields and slaughter one another. And, you know, I do hope that in this anniversary season, as I'm sure all of my fellow historians do, that the great public so interested in this looks at that question and understands it through books like Alan's. But I also hope they rise above and remember that it's the meanings, the long-term meanings of that great fight that we have to look at. Gettysburg is, for the United States, our Ezekiel's Valley of the Dry Bones. And I think only when one shudders in realizing that can you then sort of wipe yourself off.
What do you mean by the Ezekiel's Valley of the Dry Bones?
Well, it's the famous moment in the Bible, in the book of Ezekiel, where he looks out on a valley of dry bones that looks like the scorched earth and the complete devastation of humanity. And the question is, will the bones again rise? Will they have flesh? Can they be redeemed? Will it be renewed? And, of course, we see Gettysburg as the great turning point in a war that will ultimately preserve the Union and renew the United States. And we're glad for that as a people, by and large. And it's easy to look back at that and see that as all some kind of inevitable outcome. But as we've all been saying here, nothing was inevitable at Gettysburg or any place else in this war. And then the long-term meanings of that ghastly war is where we find how that revival and the recreation of an American republic took place.
Alan Gelzo, remind us of the reality of that ghastliness. I mean, we can have all this sort of talk of nobility and courage, and true, that was there, but it was also just a slaughterhouse. Remind us how bad it was, what it was like on those fields.
Tom, when we have reenactments here, there are always the people who are the casualties, but at the end of the reenactment, they always get up and walk away and go back to the tent, and everyone's friends.
Sure.
That doesn't
have a
happen.
Diet Coke.
Yeah, yeah, that doesn't happen in 1863. It's so easy to talk about the numbers of the dead or the numbers of the wounded. In fact, there's almost an unholy fascination with talking about the wounds inflicted by these weapons, which were genuinely horrific. I mean, we're talking unjacketed 58 caliber, 69 caliber lead bullets that did unspeakable things to the human anatomy.
They would take limbs right off.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, solid cannonballs bouncing along toward you like so many lethal bowling balls in an alley. Shell fragments, white-hot, razor-like splinters slicing people to bits. And when you reflect upon that, it's something which ought to turn the stomach at once, and did turn the stomachs of the people then who had to endure this, who had to endure seeing someone beside them blown to bits, spattered with human gore. There is something in us that is profoundly disturbed and should be at that kind of murderous killing. And when we reflect on that, that has to really, really sober us up to realize that war is not an adventure that knights in armor go galloping off to. We paid, and those soldiers paid, tremendous penalties. Their families, I mean, just think, 9,000 dead, all right? Mm. That's a figure. But extrapolate that out to all the households that are connected with that, all the families that are connected to those casualties.
Alan, let me get one caller right here, if I may. Florence in Hull, Massachusetts. Florence, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I'm originally from Wilmington, Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother's great-uncle, Barney McCarran, fought at Pickett's Charge, actually. And
in Gettysburg, yep.
Yeah, at Gettysburg. And he was right by one of the walls, and we went there to Gettysburg and saw how close that combat was. And he won a Congressional Medal of Honor for capturing a Confederate flag, and he also brought home a sword. He was an Irish immigrant, and the family were very poor. They were all laborers. And after the war, after Gettysburg, he was wounded again somewhere. And he wasn't able to be found to get the Medal of Honor. He subsequently fought again, we know, but when he came home, he never really recovered from the war. He was an alcoholic by then, and his two children didn't live to be very old. So it's very stirring for us as a family, but sort of a sad story for him.
The destruction that Alan Gelzo talks about, your family felt directly, even in a Congressional Medal of Honor winner, maybe especially.
Yes. And 50 years ago, the descendants in Delaware were brought to Washington, where we saw Kennedy came out of the White House specially to say hello to us. And I just thought at that point, what difference to the country each one of those particular soldiers had made individually and all together, too.
No question, including your forebear with a Medal of Honor there in Pickett's Charge. Florence, thank you for calling. Alan Gelzo, David Blight, Gary Gallagher, please stand by. We're talking about the Battle of Gettysburg at 150. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the Battle of Gettysburg at 150, Pickett's Charge, Cemetery Hill, the last full measure of devotion, the most famous battle of the Civil War, and what it meant then, maybe what it means today. Was Abraham Lincoln right? They gave their lives at Gettysburg that this nation might live. Have we made good on what they died for at Gettysburg? We have three terrific historians with us today, and we're honored to really to have all three. Gary Gallagher, professor of history at the University of Virginia, author of Becoming Confederates, Paths to a New National Loyalty. David Blight is with us from New Haven, Connecticut, professor of American history at Yale, American Oracle, his most recent book, The Civil War and the Civil Rights Era. And from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Gettysburg College, Alan Gelzo joins us. His new book is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. If I may, I want to go straight to our listeners. So many are so engaged with this piece, great piece of American history. Waxhaw, North Carolina, Neil is calling. Neil, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to ask Professor Gallagher, and actually the whole panel, I've read every book and article he's written, but a couple of points. One is, do they think the South should have pressed the attack on the first day on Cemetery Hill? Because obviously if we could have taken that, that would have changed the whole war. There's a bunch of controversy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when that did not happen, should we have fallen back between D.C. and Gettysburg and forced Meade to attack us? And thirdly, Tom, please quit calling it Pickett's Charge, because it was Pettigrew's Charge, and I'll listen to you guys off there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil. You're beyond me with that one, but we'll look at it. Gary Gallagher, pick up the questions if you'd be good enough.
I will. The last one, the Pettigrew's Charge, is the North Carolinian response to George Pickett getting all the credit for an assault that his troops made up fewer than half of the men.
Fair enough. Okay. North Carolina pride.
Yes, North Carolina pride. The first part of the question is a long-standing one. It usually has a dimension of what if Stonewall Jackson had been there? Wouldn't he have continued the attack and the Confederates would have carried Cemetery Hill?
On the first day.
On the first day and mm-hmm. won the war. That's something to speculate about. Certainly, there's absolutely no way we can gauge what would have happened then. I think Richard Ewell had good reasons for not continuing the attack at the end of the first day. I think the best thing for Lee to have done after the first day's great Confederate tactical success would have been to hunker down on Seminary Ridge and let Meade attack him. But that overlooks how fundamentally aggressive Lee was and how he always wanted to push the action, and in the end, how much faith he had in his infantry. When he explained afterward why he'd done what he had done, he said that he simply trusted his men too much and he'd asked them to do too much. He'd seen them accomplish comparable things, most recently on May the 3rd at Chancellorsville, and I think in the end, he simply believed that his infantry could carry any position he asked them to carry.
Was he blaming his men for the loss at Gettysburg with that?
No. He specifically did not blame his men. Mm-hmm. He said it was all his fault. He blamed himself for asking them to do too much.
When you, our caller Neil, with the Pettigrew's Charge pride out of North Carolina, also you heard, I'm sure we all did, the we and us there, of the
yes,
Southern perspective on this battle. He's from North Carolina, but what about that? You teach out of Virginia, Gary. What about the Southern perspective on this battle? Do you still feel a live sort of Confederate-style perspective on this? What is it?
I think there's some of that. I think Gettysburg became much more important after the war to former Confederates than it was during the war to Confederates, because it became for them this great lost moment. Where anything was possible. Faulkner reflected that perfectly in the bit from Intruder in the Dust that we heard earlier.
Yes.
It became the great moment that showed this transcendent Confederate valor from the former Confederates' point of view, and it fit nicely into their post-war construction of how the Confederacy never really could have won because the odds were simply too great, but weren't they brave in trying as hard as they did? It was a perfect way for them to get at certain themes that post facto helped them make sense of their cataclysmic defeat during the war and the loss of everything that they had wanted to preserve in pursuing secession in the first place. David was right earlier in saying we need to keep our eye on the big issues that are at stake here, and one of them was once the Emancipation Proclamation was in place, everything was on the table for Confederates, that is, white Southerners who supported the Confederacy, including R.E. Lee. If they lost the war, they lost white supremacy, they lost control over 3.5 million enslaved black people. They couldn't imagine that world, and the stakes could not have been higher. That's all in the background as this action plays out in Adams County, Pennsylvania, in July 1863.
Let me get a call right here from Peter in Boston, Massachusetts. Peter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a great player. Yeah, I was wondering what your history experts is that I feel like recently, like the last 20, 30 years, it seems to be not enough credit is given for the actual Union soldiers that fought the battles. For example, and it seems like when they teach American history in school, it's Lincoln-Douglas debate, the Emancipation Proclamation in Massachusetts, the 54th Black Brigade that did a great job, but they don't really give... To me, which I think is not emphasized enough, is the Union soldiers who won at Antietam so that they could put the Emancipation to actually be enforced, a Gettysburg. And I guess that the question is enough giving credit for the soldiers, the privates from Massachusetts, Illinois, and, you know, what beat the Southerners were these Union soldiers who came up and got slaughtered.
Yeah, I hear you, Peter. I mean, we heard of the Congressional Medal of Honor that went to our Delaware callers of forebear. Of course, at the same time as Gettysburg, Vicksburg was going on Mississippi, and I sympathize. My Union forebears were fighting there. David Blight, what about how we accredit the effort here? Do the rank and file Union soldiers or anybody else get lost in the shuffle of great elements?
Well, the Union soldiers don't lack for respect, although Gary wrote a quite persuasive book recently called The Union War that argued pretty much what the caller is saying. There has been an enormous revolution in the study of slavery and emancipation in the past generation or two, and that's perhaps what the caller is pointing to. And sometimes the teeter-totter swings one way or the other, and we emphasize one field, one argument, perhaps more than another. But it used to be that most Americans grew up learning only about the valor of soldiers, mutual valor of both sides, and a great fight out of which came a greater nation. The lost cause tradition, in many ways, the South's argument, Gary was implying, that they never really fought for slavery, that they were never truly defeated on the battlefield and only defeated by industrialization, had almost taken over the national consciousness in the early to mid-20th century. So, you know, these arguments come in and out of vogue, but in the long run, we have to always find a way to keep these two great stories in tension. The story on the ground, the valor of those soldiers, the maneuvers by generals, the fight. And then, what is it really all about? What are its legacies? How do we know those legacies when we see them? What are the meanings over time? And what were the reasons? Was it all worth it? How do we even ask and answer those questions?
Those are as big as it gets, and we'll turn in that direction. Alan Gelzo here, a listener, asks, says, what about historical references to the Army of Northern Virginia rounding up African Americans during this campaign and sending them south to slavery? Alan?
This is one of the stories that has often gotten shoved to the back, and I think there's a great mistake made when that is allowed to happen. The Army of Northern Virginia coming into Pennsylvania was not just coming as a Southern army. It was not just coming as Robert E. Lee's army. It was, as David rightly says, it was coming as the army of slavery. It had large numbers of slaves providing logistical support for it. You don't really see this at reenactments, do you? But the truth of the matter is that the Army of Northern Virginia is coming up with as many as 10,000, maybe as many as 30,000 black slaves performing all the essential tasks that in the Union Army had to be performed by enlisted personnel or by civilian contractors. And when the Confederate Army comes into Pennsylvania, true to that spirit, when it finds free black people in Pennsylvania, it rounds them up. It imprisons them. It participates in a slave hunt. And it takes free Pennsylvanians and ties them up into coffles and marches them off to the Richmond slave markets so that they can be sold into slavery. And when white Pennsylvanians protested this, white civilians protested this. The response they got from Confederate officers was, well, when you come down into the South, your army takes our property, so we're coming up here and we're taking your property. Except, wait a minute, those are human beings. They're not property. I think if there's anything which puts a stain on the escutcheon of the Army of Northern Virginia in the Gettysburg campaign, it is this one great shameful blot of an army which marches onto free soil so that it can enslave, well, we estimate perhaps as many as 500 black people who were tracked down, captured, and then sold into slavery.
We go to Catherine in Burlington, Vermont. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just really wanted to bring some information to the table, so to speak, let people know, listeners across the nation, that the Battle of Gettysburg impacted a lot of families, our family included specifically. We had a great-great-grandfather who was a doctor in Boston, and when war finally broke out, he gave his services over entirely and moved up to the ranks to captain during the course of the Civil War and was at the Battle of Gettysburg, my apologies. And so we have always felt a sense of pride in our families that we have tirelessly worked for freedom across the nation for all people, regardless of who they are, where they come from. And so I just wanted to bring that to the table and share that with others.
Catherine,
I'm sure there are a lot of other people that have done the same thing.
I'm sure there are, but I appreciate your call. In that sense, a very real sense of legacy there, a commitment then and now, across all these 150 years. Let me get one more. At Martin in Fairfax, South Carolina. Thank you, Catherine. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. 26 years ago, Tom, I graduated from the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg, and I just want to say that you can't live in that town without having a sense of the history. We even had cannonballs and shot shells in the exterior walls of some of our seminary buildings. I was a infantry officer in the National Guard, Pennsylvania National Guard at the time, and, you know, to be situated on that battlefield, you know, you really just got a sense of the key terrain and how the armies maneuvered. And, you know, I'd go out jogging in the morning and, you know, I'd, you know, run down Seminary Ridge and, you know, past all of the monuments, General Lee's monument, and at the site where the supposedly Pickett turned and, you know, began the march across towards the Emmitsburg Road, and it just was truly, truly a wonderful educational experience in not only my academic sense, but also my historical sense.
It can really send chills down your spine. Martin, I appreciate your call. Our time grows short here, so forgive me, but I want to put this to our guests. I mean, David, you raised the issue of the legacy and the question of worth it. You know, in the popular telling, there seems to be, from much of the country, no question about that these days. But what about in your assessment, the legacy and the worth?
Well, long-term, one almost has to say it was worth it to preserve a republic and to end slavery and rewrite the U.S. Constitution and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments
Yes.
Provide the long-term possibility and model to the world of an inclusive biracial republic. As for legacies, they're everywhere. They're all around us. They're today most easily seen in our raging political debates over federalism, the relationship of states' rights to federal rights, federal power to state power, in this new conservative approach of the Supreme Court and new conservative approaches in so many state legislatures, and in our race relations, which is an unending, probably eternal dilemma in American society. Whenever we debate the nature of federalism. And whenever we debate the problem of race in the United States before law, we are still playing out the legacies of the American Civil War. And I think most of the people abroad in the world who are so fascinated with this part of our history are interested because they seem to sense that. And to the caller who just called, I mean, that is so true, of course. Gettysburg is as good an example as anywhere in the United States of the power of place in memory. That is sacred ground, to overuse a term that's overused. But that the power of place is where we also learn to reflect and hopefully reflect on long-term meanings and not only on the authenticity of the fight.
At 150, Lincoln reminding us there, well, really almost redefining the nation and reminding us what was fought for on the battlefield at Gettysburg, that last full measure of devotion, and whether government of the people, by the people, for the people, perish from this earth. Stakes can't get much higher than that. Grateful to all three of you for being with us today. Gary Gallagher, University of Virginia, author of Becoming Confederates. David Blight, author of American Oracle at Yale. Alan Gelzo, professor of history at Gettysburg College, author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Thanks very much to all three of you for being with us today. We go out with Soldier's Dream. Nashville producer and songwriter Tom Utes performed with us at On Point Live in Nashville a couple of months ago. He's put together an album of songs inspired by the Civil War. It's called the 1861 album. We go out with The Soldier's Dream. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.